What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know?
Because elephants are on the move and we do not want to stand in the way, says the city of Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review, where we spend 1 hour making you smart about the news that took an entire week to produce. You learn what's the buzz, and then you can talk intelligently about it this weekend. My guests are the editorial director of The Stranger and host of Savage Love Podcast, Dan Savage. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
From the Seattle Channel Civic Cocktail, Joni Balter. Hi, Joni.
Good morning.
And the Mossback at crosscut.com. Hi, Canute.
Bill.
Are you the only one who's ridden an elephant in this room?
There's an elephant in the room, and you've been on its back. I've been on its back, the poor thing. Yeah, no, Woodland Park Zoo used to offer elephant rides, and
they had this little box strapped to the back
that you'd fill with kids, and then it would wander around, and you'd be kind of rocking. And they used to do that at the circus, too.
If the elephants are rocking, don't come and knock it. So, bumper sticker on that elephant.
And don't block them, says the city council this week. Do not block a moving elephant headed to Oklahoma City. The Woodland Park Zoo announced it is sending its two Asian elephants not to a wildlife sanctuary, but to the Oklahoma City Zoo. Seattle's mayor says he's disappointed. Some city council members are disappointed. Opponents said, well, you're the city council. Block the move, or at least punish the Woodland Park Zoo. Who thinks the city council should stand in the way of elephants?
Well, I guess I do. I think that there's enough sentiment and there's enough sort of political will to try to create a compromise or something on this. There's no need for the elephants to go
What's the compromise? One elephant to the zoo and one elephant to the
zoo? The compromise is slow down the process.
That's always the compromise in Seattle.
All right,
is there some way we can slow down this process?
Yes, but slow down the process with a better result. Try that for a second, Dan. And what I'm talking about...
How can elephants go more slowly than they already do?
Okay, back to my point,
yes.
As I was saying.
Go on.
The idea here would be that there is no need to transfer these elephants in the middle of winter. Has anybody checked out Oklahoma City's weather? There are some thoughts that the transfers in the middle of winter aren't healthy anyway.
Especially the winter we've been having compared with the winter they've been having.
So the idea would be to just, doesn't the city council have enough heft to them and the mayor together to go change maybe the outcome of this? That's what I'm arguing.
They do give the zoo lots of money. So why doesn't the city have the power or will to...
They give the zoo one-third of its budget. Now, if you want to flash ahead a little bit, the mayor doesn't want to sort of punish the other animals with a budget cut that would come as sort of... a penalty for this decision, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, we're shrinking the giraffe pen because of your budget cuts.
But if they threaten to ding the zoo, they could leverage that to change the decision that the zoo has made and send these elephants to a sanctuary. And that the city, the hand-wringing that's going on at City Hall about this, the pretending to be helpless in the face of this decision is very annoying. It's representative democracy. These are elected officials.
Thing.
There's a constituency that's very angry. I think if you polled it, and I don't know if there's any polls on it, most people would probably support moving the elephants not from one crappy zoo to another crappy zoo, but to a sanctuary. And yet the city council and the mayor is acting like they don't actually have any power here to do anything at all about this decision. And that's not true. And that's what's so aggravating about it, even perhaps aggravating to people who support the zoo's decision.
Well, we'll talk more about that in a moment. You brought up what the people think. There was a city council meeting this week with public testimony. You're going to hear the voices of two people. First, a former zookeeper who wants the elephant sent to a sanctuary. Then a Woodland Park Zoo volunteer who wants them to go to Oklahoma City.
There are some animals that do not belong in zoos because zoos cannot meet their physical, psychological, and social needs. Elephants are at the top of this list.
If you are trying to find a placement for a beloved family member, who best to decide? The experts and the people who love them? You would not allow activists and government officials to make that decision for you.
And that last point is what city council members said. They said, well, I'm not a zoologist. We're going to leave it. Ultimately, we have our uninformed opinion, but we're going to leave it to the zoo to decide what happens to elephants.
Is I'm not a zoologist the lefty Seattle Democrat equivalent of the Republican? I'm not a scientist.
Right, right.
Response to climate change.
Well, I do think that they're worried, and it does seem weak and limp thinking to me, that they're worried that it becomes a slippery slope. So if they listen to the activists on the elephants, then they'll go in and say, wait, how are those penguins doing? And it'll just keep going on and on and on to every different exhibit.
Yeah, but that may be a good thing, actually, Joni. I mean, I understand. I always find zoos rather depressing. A lot
even
of the
when
animals,
you were riding the elephant. What about the day
when I was a kid? No, I enjoyed it a lot, but I don't necessarily think that those, I mean, we've evolved in terms of how we regard animals, how we treat animals. It would seem that if you've made a decision that you can't take care of these animals, that you would want them to retire to the best possible environment. So it seems like going to a sanctuary rather than a zoo is a good decision. But it seems to me we ought to reevaluate zoos as a thing. We know more about animals. We know more about what they can tolerate, what they can't tolerate. And maybe they should go through a more aggressive divestiture.
And we also have a thing with Oklahoma City. I mean, first they get our basketball team, then our elephants.
Right. Enough already.
Enough already.
Haven't
with
we
this,
suffered enough?
Yeah.
Well, talking about reevaluating zoos, the only circus I can name is going down that slippery slope, right? Because the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus said this week that it's going to stop using elephants by 2018. They said there's been a mood shift among our consumers. A lot of people aren't comfortable with us touring with our elephants. Plus, certain cities and counties have passed anti-circus and anti-elephant ordinances. So, I mean, that is the symbol, I think, besides the slogan, the greatest show on earth, I think of elephants when I think of the circus. So it seemed like it's happening.
The change is definitely happening. It feels like, you know, there have been years and years of concern and protest and all of this, and now it's manifesting in A, the reaction to what's happening here, and B, the traveling roadshow.
And this is of a piece with, I think, the political movement and gestation crates for pigs, which are smart and sensitive animals, and the way we treat them on factory farms and chickens and everything else. I think this is of a piece with a movement towards recognizing that animals can suffer. And if we torture them on the way to dinner, or we torture them on the way to the circus, or we torture them at our zoos, that we're all implicated by that. And our humanity is diminished by that. And I think that's good that we're starting to think and talk about that stuff. And we need to move on it. We need to move faster on it, particularly where factory farming is concerned.
Yeah, Ringling Brothers is not moving that fast, 2018. But then they will phase out the elephants. Circus Tigers have called a news conference for this afternoon at 2 o'clock. We don't know what they're going to say. We have a reporter going to it. We can only speculate how they might feel.
Yep.
Okay. So, bottom line, the move of Chai and Bamboo, Woodland Park's Asian elephants. If you want to see them,
the most inhumane thing we do to elephants is the names we slap on them.
Which one don't you like?
Either.
No?
And how many kids are there in Seattle who are named Chai and Bamboo at this stage, I wonder? I mean, that's why we need to get rid of these elephants, because Chai and Bamboo are being made fun of at Stevens Middle School.
And if we don't ban those names, we're all implicated.
That's right.
Okay. So these elephants could move as early as mid-March. I mean, like, fast. So,
right.
You know, hopefully it's getting warmer in Oklahoma City.
One hopes.
And so, bottom line, you're saying slippery slope. Are the penguins next? If anybody's okay with the slippery slope.
They're going to be.
It's a penguin.
They're going to
be
fine.
Yeah.
They're going to be fine.
It'll be okay. KUOW's Week in Review with Dan Savage, Joni Balter, and Knute Berger. And we're going to be right back. Stay with us. We take a week's worth of news and condense, compost it, if you will. We'll be talking about that later in the show. What can we compost? Think of something that you don't want to compost. That's the thing we're going to be talking about later this hour on The Week in Review. With Joni Balter, Knute Berger, Dan Savage, I'm Bill Radke. And 10 years ago this month, King County made a very bold promise to end homelessness in 10 years. Well, the number of people sleeping on the streets and in shelters in King County has, of course, gone up. Was it a terrible idea to make ending homelessness your publicly stated goal? Someone is nodding. And why did the plan fail? Well, KUOW's John Ryan brought you a series of reports this week. And we don't usually do this, but his opening piece does such a good job of laying out the situation and introducing you to people who are dealing with homelessness in many different ways that I'm going to play the entire piece. It's about 7 minutes long. We're going to listen with you, and we will discuss what we've learned. So here's John Ryan's report on the county's 10-year plan to end homelessness.
You can find evidence of Seattle's rising tide of homelessness in lots of places.
So this is 3rd Avenue.
Angie Davis takes me on a tour of SoDo. On weekdays, commuters park along the curbs of this mostly industrial area south of downtown Seattle. And 24/7, so do the tents, recreational vehicles, and cardboard structures of the homeless. Davis heads a group called the SoDo Business Improvement Association.
There's somebody living underneath that box truck right there in the back, sleeping bag and a bunch of stuff pushed underneath there, so we got a little bit of shelter from the weather.
We drive by one stretch of sidewalk where cardboard homes squat between a razor wire fence and a Mercedes-Benz. Down the block, more cardboard homes next to a Cadillac Escalade.
I would not walk down that street by myself.
According to the latest count in January, more than 3,700 people live on the streets of King County. An even bigger number have some temporary roof over their heads in homeless shelters or transitional housing. At the wheel of her Mercedes, Davis says she empathizes with people living on the streets, but she asks,
why is it other big cities don't have the same issue?
More people are without homes in the Seattle area than in other cities our size. Only the New York, Los Angeles, and Las Vegas areas have bigger homeless populations than we do.
My name is Vince Matalonis. I work at the United Way of King County as their director of ending homelessness.
That's a pretty ambitious job title.
It's a very ambitious job title. Some days it's harder to live up to than others, but that's our aspiration in a community like ours. We shouldn't have thousands of people that are homeless.
Vince Matalonis was part of a group of government and non-government officials that formed back in 2001. Over the next few years, they came up with King County's 10-year plan to end homelessness. Around the same time that Committee to End Homelessness was getting started, the Bush administration essentially required communities around the country to come up with these kinds of plans if they wanted to keep getting federal dollars to help the homeless. The Bush administration focused on ending chronic homelessness. The long-term homeless are a small but costly fraction of the homeless population. Many communities, including the Seattle area, aimed higher. They came up with 10-year plans to end homelessness altogether. Here's Vince Matalonis.
We're really fortunate. We live in a very compassionate community.
Seattle's liberal voters and politicians don't mind spending money on social problems, and there's a lot of money here. King County has the largest United Way in the country, and the world's wealthiest foundation, the Gates Foundation, puts money toward the homeless in its hometown. All told, roughly $1 billion has gone to help the homeless over the past decade in King County. Nearly 6,000 units of affordable housing have been built. That's more than any city except New York or L.A. Yet the effort is losing ground.
Boy, it would be nice to be able to say there's one or two main reasons why we've not achieved our goal of ending homelessness. Unfortunately, it's so much more complicated than that.
Get to know even a few homeless people, and you'll find out there are many ways to wind up on the streets. One morning at the Connection Shelter in downtown Seattle, I spoke with Aaron McFadder, a man named Michael, who declined to give his last name, Gary Eyerly, and Jonathan Morrell.
I worked on that tunnel job down there at the Husky Stadium. I was down there for 5 months, and I was doing really good, and all of a sudden got laid off, and I need some work.
Everybody in here got a different situation in here why they became homeless. In my scenario is, yeah, I just got out of prison. That's why I'm down here.
They need to quit trying to charge $1,300 a month for a 400-square-foot studio.
Yeah, like they're doing in the U District.
I was in a car accident, and after that, I mean, just everything just spiraled out of control. Snapped my neck. So I was unable to work for a while, and I just fell down on bad luck. A few years later, I'm still trying to pick up the pieces, you know. I've been through some real tough times, and I mean, you know what I'm saying, I'm down at the rock bottom right now. I have nothing. And I feel like it's nowhere to go but up from here.
Even though we're all frustrated and beyond frustrated and disappointed with some of the results, including the increased count on the streets, which is devastating, we have accomplished a lot of good work that we have been recognized for.
Dan Brettler has been a leader of the Committee to End Homelessness since it began. He's also the CEO of Car Toys.
Thousands of people have gotten a roof over their head. The problem is there's been a significantly higher inbound flow of people coming into the homeless cycle than we anticipated.
Homeless advocates point to forces far beyond the committee's influence, everything from broken mental health systems to racial disparities. 2/3 of all homeless people in King County are people of color, even though people of color only make up 1/3 of the population. Dan Brettler singles out the recession that hit midway through the 10-year plan, but he says even the booming economy of present-day Seattle is still dumping people on the streets. And this might not be the kind of talk you'd expect to hear from a CEO.
We have a very thriving, healthy, growing GDP economy. We're creating poverty at unprecedented levels at the same time. That's a broken economy fundamentally, so there's something inherently wrong with our economic structure.
Of course, many of the root causes of homelessness aren't limited to King County. So why are things getting worse here when they aren't nationally? One reason, according to Vince Matalonis, the 10-year plan didn't focus enough on root causes, like the lack of affordable housing in this booming metropolis.
Seattle's the fastest growing city in the country last year. So rich, poor, and otherwise, we attract a lot of people here. A lot of people get here and find that they struggle with the cost of living and the cost of housing, and which puts them at risk for homelessness.
Among other things, the 10-year plan focused on providing permanent housing for the homeless rather than shelter beds. But since housing is expensive and slow to build, the county wound up with even more people lacking shelter of any kind.
You know, we have this saying, we can't build our way out of it. We're never going to be able to build enough housing if we don't reduce the number of people becoming homeless.
The Committee to End Homelessness has been working to revise its strategy now that the 10-year plan is ending and local homelessness is worse than ever. Committee members mostly avoid saying anybody did anything wrong or promised too much in the old plan. The language of choice is that they're pivoting to a next chapter. Talk of ending homelessness is being replaced with a less lofty goal, making homelessness rare and brief when it does occur. King County has a long way to go on both those goals. Right now, people typically go without a home for more than 4 months. 3 weeks is the target. The committee's members say a new strategy will enable them to help the homeless more effectively, but they say that tackling root causes of homelessness, like inequity, can't just be one committee's job. It'll take the whole community. I'm John Ryan, KUOW News.
And this is KUOW's Week in Review. Okay, so my guests and I have been listening along with you to this summary of the plan that King County announced a decade ago to end homelessness in a decade. That obviously didn't happen. What was your reaction?
Well, just as a general note, I hate it. You know, I'm a lefty, I'm a progressive.
This is Dan Savage, by the way.
Idealism, yeah, but also realism. It drives me nuts when people say, we're going to end homelessness in 10 years. We're going to stop all new HIV infections. We're going to end hunger. No, you're not, right? And setting a goal like that, when you get to the end of whatever period you declared you were going to end hunger, homelessness, HIV infections in, is just going to result in people feeling despair and people becoming cynical about some other attempt to fix or address or ameliorate or mitigate a problem. We're not going to end homelessness really ever. We're not going to end HIV infections ever. We're not going to end hunger ever. We can address these problems. We can decrease the number of people who are being infected, decrease the number of people being impacted by homelessness. And we should set realistic goals, not pump people full of idealistic expectations that we know before we even start we're going to fall short on.
Who thinks the public plan End Homelessness in 10 Years was a good idea?
I think it's poorly named is what I'm...
Yeah, that's my point. This
I'm
is a general
with Dan.
Point.
If you say that, certainly you know at 4 years, 5 years, 6 years in this case, that you're not ending homelessness. In a way, it's increasing. And so I think the name sort of set them up.
The people on the committee will tell you that what's larger than any despair, I think you said, Dan, at not actually ending homelessness, what's bigger than that is the galvanization, the attention that even comes to the issue to mobilize to say, as a county, this is the mountain we're going to go up, even whether we actually summit it or not.
But the takeaway from the story is we mobilized, we spent $1 billion, and the problem is worse than ever. So maybe we shouldn't have spent a cent, is what a lot of people are going to take away from this. Rather than backing way the hell up and addressing the systemic problems of poverty, of transportation, lack of access to medical care, and maybe the proposals we need are a minimum income, which is so radical, a left-wing socialist plan or proposal that the last president who made that proposal was Richard Nixon.
Hmm. Well, there's a couple of things here. You know, you can take away many things, as the report showed. So one thing is, this is a boom city. So one reason, if you want to count this or calculate what happened, is it's a boom city to people who don't have jobs, too. And they came, and the one person who was in the report worked on the tunnel for a while, and then he didn't.
Got laid off.
And then he didn't have a job. there are many construction jobs here, so you have to wonder, you know, if he will or can get one of those. But the fact is, a boom attracts people who think they're going to be in on the boom, and they either will or won't be in on the boom. And then the other key figure in there for me was $1 billion. So we are known, and I've heard this from many people, as a caring community that is willing to spend money on homeless folks and help them. And so I don't know if the two go together exactly, but the two are part of the explanation.
But we're a caring community with a lot of hypocrites in it. I'd like to see a Venn diagram between people who think homelessness is a problem and we need to fix it, but also oppose apartments, single room occupancy hotels, rezoning the city so less of it is zoned for single family housing. You know, the same city that is crapping its pants because apartments are being built, which is creating cheap and affordable housing without subsidies, who then turn around and say that they care about homeless people and want something done, are hypocrites, and they need to look inside.
Knut, you're next, but that brings me briefly to our Facebook page where we're having this discussion, and you can join Facebook, KUW Public Radio. Eric says, we don't have more unemployment or drug addicts or sad stories. We're not more heartless. We just never changed from being a city of single-family homes to a city of apartments. There's too little cheap housing, no rent-stabilized apartments, no 75-year-old cheaper large apartment buildings. What was here was torn down. We're live tweeting the show right now at KUOW, and we can add more of your comments. Knut, I'd like to add yours.
Just to Dan's point, which I actually agree with, housing is a key component, and particularly off-the-books housing, and that's something that's it's unregulated, but more is being drawn into regulation, and for good reason. I mean, arguments that apartments have to have certain kinds of utilities or appliances. I mean, there are people
or a certain number of parking spots.
Well, there are people living in places like in the International District in old places, and they're paying maybe $100 a month to live in something, you know, the size of a closet. But what's happening is people are going into those buildings and upgrading them and, you know, making a lot of changes. And so we're not building enough low-income housing, but we're also redeveloping and eliminating and regulating out a lot of the sort of available housing or off-the-books kind of housing that used to handle fairly large numbers of people. You know, Joni's right, and I thought the gentleman in the thing who was critiquing, we sort of have the worst of two phenomena. One is that prosperity attracts homeless people because it attracts everyone. Oh. Everybody wants to come. Seattle's been through this before. When you get a real problem, though, is when the prosperity is divided so unequally in a kind of Gilded Age style prosperity that you begin tossing out more and more people because they can't afford the rents, they can't find the job, or the labor force that's flourishing is way beyond the means of the poor and minorities and others to get into.
I would just interject that I don't think our prosperity is attracting homeless people. That I think people might hear that and then think, you know, why did they come here? They shouldn't have come here. It attracts people who have just enough money to house themselves for a few months while they look for work, and then they don't find it, and then what happens? They don't have enough money to go back home, to move to another city, or to hang on while they look for work.
On our Facebook page, I think Pamela gets to the heart of something. She says, and we impound the tiny campers people have been reduced to living in. We are smarter and kinder than this. I know we are. Are we smarter and kinder than this?
Well, not enough. I mean, one of the problems is that almost all of the homeless services are in Seattle. Because the other cities and suburbs don't want them. Literally, the homeless services that you can get in a city like Tacoma is a ticket to Seattle, literally a bus ticket to come
and
here.
And all the long-term trends are poverty is moving to the suburbs and out of the right. Middle of the cities. And suburbs aren't served by transit. People can't get to jobs. People move to the suburbs because it's the only place they can afford to live. And then they're dependent on their cars. And if something goes wrong with their cars, they're SOL, as was the case with the piece that played on KUOW this morning about the family out in the burbs who is struggling to house themselves. And one of their big nightmares for finding work or finding a place to live is that they don't have an automobile.
But to Skip's earlier point about the disparity here, you know, the runaway growth and development, you know, we're choking on our success in some ways. And so you take certain neighborhoods, see Ballard, see International District, where the development is going so quickly that these folks are the folks that have, you know, some kind of a bit of housing are being forced out.
But the development's going so quickly, and there's no opposition to luxury development, really. There's griping about it, but there's no political opposition to it. There's opposition to low-income development and to the construction of apartments, the kinds of places that people who are struggling financially might be able to afford.
Let's talk about one more kind of opposition, possibly. We talked with one of the architects of that 10-year plan to end homelessness, Bill Hobson from Seattle's Downtown Emergency Service Center, and asked him, what would it cost to actually end homelessness in King County?
It's got to be close to $1 billion to build enough housing to take everybody out of shelters and all the 3,000 people sleeping on the street. It's a huge price tag. I'm not neglecting that. But don't we take on service projects of equal or greater magnitude all the time? What is the tunnel to replace the viaduct cost? You know, I know that's a painful topic right now for all of us, but we accepted that price tag. How committed are we to helping people that are so extremely marginalized in our community that they're forced to sleep outside?
What would happen if King County asked voters for $1 billion to end homelessness?
Okay, so they would never ask voters for $1 billion, but you do have in the mayor's Housing Affordability Task Force some ideas along these lines. They will not be that number. They will be bigger than the last housing levy, for example, because the new housing levy comes up, I believe, next year. And everyone who knows anything about that task force says it's going to be more money. And again, that's in Seattle.
How many hundreds of millions of dollars did we spend to house a football team and a baseball team? We can find the money to park Paul Billionaire Allen's football team in a brand new downtown stadium. We can't find the money for this. It's appalling. Or for schools.
So there's one takeaway from all of this, and I commend you to this series. We've been talking about this all week because of this anniversary. So KUOW.org, you can search homeless and really meet a whole bunch of people coming at this from a whole bunch of ways and really living these issues out. This is the Week in Review, analyzing the top stories of the week. We've got much more to do. We're going to talk about No Snow, Who Cares? What is Olympia doing and not doing? And how is it okay to talk about race? Stay tuned. Not this year, Dan says, to the question, Dan, you're a snowboarder, aren't you?
Yes.
But no.
Not this year. There's no snow.
It's been an awful winter, as you know. Okay. A terrible winter for snow play with levels at record lows for Washington and Oregon. But this week, KOW's EarthFix reporter Ashley Ahern said, don't panic. Total precipitation for most of the Northwest is at normal or above normal. It's just coming as rain, not snow.
We're doing just fine at the moment.
Mike Hansen is a spokesperson for Bonneville Power Administration. It manages 31 federal dams on the Columbia and Snake Rivers and provides about a third of the electricity for the Northwest. He says that as bad as things might look out your window or on your local ski slope,
that doesn't give you the total picture. What's really important to us in particular is what is happening at the higher elevations throughout the Northern Rockies going into Canada.
Snow levels there are looking pretty good, and Hansen says that snowmelt will feed into BPA's reservoirs on the Columbia and Snake throughout the season.
The Columbia is fine. The Snake's fine. City of Seattle has been keeping its reservoirs full of rainwater. So can you officially feel good about our weather?
It's all about the storage, don't you think? So you had Tacoma and Seattle both talking about how they were sort of on this from the beginning. They knew that the snowpack itself wasn't that good, but that the total rain, not great, but not really scary either. And so, yeah, they seem to be storing it. We'll see what the weather's like. Who thinks it's going to rain like crazy for the rest of the spring?
Well, that's one of the concerns they have is the reservoirs that I'm talking about. They say the Cedar River system, which is where Seattle gets its water supply. Those reservoirs are much more full than normal, and they don't have an infinite capacity. So one of the things that concerns them is when you get sort of late winter storms, and those get predicted in advance, like in 4 days there's going to be a storm. So they have to actually let water out of the reservoirs that would be drinking water. They have to let it go before the storm hits so they have room to take whatever the storm brings. And then if the storm doesn't happen, and we all know how dicey the weather is, they've lowered the reservoirs, and then they have to hope that they fill back up again. So they're having to manage the water systems up there much more carefully. I was up there this week looking at the Bear Hills and the Cedar River. In the Cedar River watershed, the snowpack is, I think, 8% of normal. A lot of their snow meters way up high are reading zero snowpack. So
these sticks sticking way up out of the ground.
Exactly. And the interesting thing is, and Cliff Mass has written about this, this is a preview of the kind of winter we're going to have in 2070. This will be the norm. And that's what almost all the climate models suggest are going to be like this
winter. But Cliff Mass also wrote a piece that said that this wasn't actually a climate change kind of year.
No, right, those are two different things.
Two different things. Yeah, no,
it wasn't a function of it, but it was
Nobody's saying that this year was caused by climate change, right. But what it is it giving us a preview of what climate change right. is projected to look like. And the models show that Seattle makes out pretty good. The warm and wet, we're going to have enough water. What it really gets scary is when you start looking east of the mountains.
Scary is all the Texans who are going to move here.
Yeah,
when their state burns to the ground. And Floridians, when their state is underwater.
You joke, but there have been region by region guesses as to who's going to fare how in climate change. And we are one of the happy spots,
but
relatively
Canada
speaking.
Canada wins. Canada, we should all be emigrating to Canada.
Yes.
Okay, so there's your takeaway.
Yeah, you do not want to be in the Great Basin or Florida.
Right. And a late winter storm could come or we're going to lose our water. So thanks for bumming us out, Kenneth. We were feeling so good. Seriously, though, you know what? It was better to be homeless in Seattle this winter.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
anything
it giveth and it taketh away.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be homeless in New York City right now.
No.
Or ever.
By the way, Kentucky had like a 5-hour traffic jam. In New York, a plane spun off the runway. Wasn't it LaGuardia or something?
Yes.
I cannot help hearing the news and just thinking, it's not bad to be here.
Well, I think that's the PR problem that the people who support carbon taxes and things have, which is they talk about global warming, but when people go out and experience the winter climate of 2070, they're like, great.
Yeah.
You're not going to bring a snowball into the floor of the Senate, are you?
Yeah, it's giving hope to the people who plant palm trees here.
Let's see who can get hope from Olympia. We're going to talk a little about that, like I said, about how it's okay to talk about race and more when we continue on the Week in Review. He could be working on the latest episode of his Savage Love podcast. Instead, he's here, so it's probably going to be a terrible episode the next one, right?
We've already got the next couple of Savage Love casts in the bank.
Oh, rats. Dan Savage from The Stranger.
Which is why I have all the profanity out of my system, and I've managed to sit here for 45 minutes without swearing.
Yes, we're getting a lot of comments on Twitter at KUOW. Norman says, where's the profanity, Dan? Where are the F-bombs? Yeah. Dan Savage, Joni Balter from Bloomberg View and Seattle Channel, and Knute Berger, Seattle Magazine, and of course the Mossback at crosscut.com. We're talking about our lovely weather and how great carbon is. So let's talk about we're not going to spend a ton of time on this, but what's going on with lawmakers and paying for road projects and gas taxes. And can you give us the gist from this week? What do we need
to know? Well, it's interesting because there's this thing that seems to go on in Olympia, which especially when you have a split legislature like we have, which is the Republicans are kind of showing off, like, this is how we govern. And the Democrats are showing off, this is how we govern, even if the bills have no chance of passing.
Can we just make the session like 2 weeks long? Because
after the latest revenue forecast, and we just lock them in a room for 2 weeks.
Get it done.
You know, get it done. Send the governor in and out whenever, you know, we feel like we need a little pressure in there.
I think that's a much better idea than this idea that they should all get paid twice as much and work full time, you know, the professional legislature, you know. And what's going on now is the House is passing various bills, minimum wage, voting rights, sick leave, things like that, that Republicans are generally skeptical of. the Republicans have passed a transportation bill. Surprise, surprise. But it has all kinds of poison pills in it.
Yeah, I would just want to underline that for a moment. This is not the Democrats. The Republicans approved a gas tax.
That's right.
The Senate Majority Leader, the Republican, said, I haven't voted for a gas tax in 20 years, something like that.
Yeah. So,
thank you, legal pot, which is we probably have to thank for that moment.
This is something that the so-called majority coalition legislature, Senate last session, couldn't get a kind of compromise and get a tax approved. But now they have gotten Republicans on record for a tax. But they are also on record as being against carbon emission limitations,
right?
Low carbon fuels and that kind of thing. And so this stuff always ends up having to be negotiated, but we're waiting for the House. But everybody's looking at the next election, and the Democrats are sort of in that courting phase where it's kind of, well, you know, they're talking to their constituents. They're talking to people. Here are the kind of things we pass if we were, again, in charge of both houses.
So rolling out these bills and approving these bills isn't an empty gesture. It's laying a chit down. Give us back the Senate. Keep Inslee in the governor's mansion, and this is what you will get.
And here's how that can work. So, as you know, we did a civic cocktail panel on carbon this week. And as you know, that if there isn't something done, for example, the governor's cap and trade, there's all this talk of an initiative, a carbon tax initiative 2016. That's not subtle, and neither is the fact that the House passed a $12 statewide minimum wage, because that's also a setup for 2016. You know, think of the climate of your voters, of who you bring out for the governor's race, for the Senate race, for all of this. So there's also talk of an initiative on a $12 minimum wage. And if you think about that, that is creating quite the liberal climate like we had in 2012.
Again, let me highlight. We already, the Washington state has the highest minimum wage in America.
Right? And a booming economy. And a booming economy. And we're always told by people who oppose hikes in the minimum wage that you can't raise it because it'll destroy jobs. And we have a better economy than Idaho, where you can pay people with dirt and pebbles.
Go on, Joni.
Well, well, there it is.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is that everyone is sort of showing, here's what we would do if we were in charge, like Skip says. But even if we're not in charge, you know, there's that initiative that will come out and create a certain type of voting climate in 2016. So probably carbon and probably minimum wage.
The new gay marriage.
There's your takeaway. By the way, we had this jobs report this morning.
Sensational.
300,000 jobs, basically. Stocks plummeted because, you know, interest rates are going to go up.
We just heard that Obamacare was going to be a job killer for such a long time. And if there was any justice in the world, it would be a job killer. It would kill the jobs of everyone who said Obamacare would be a job killer. All those pundits on the right would be fired tomorrow.
Dan Savage on KUOW's Week in Review. Knute Berger, Joni Balter. An Eastern Washington state senator this week said he regrets how he talked about race. Sunnyside Senator Jim Honeyford was discussing the racial impacts that laws can have, and he was saying essentially that it's not just the law's fault. People of different races already act in different ways. He said, quote, "It's generally accepted that the poor are more likely to commit crimes, and generally, I think, accepted that people of color are more likely poor than not." We'll unpack that in a moment. Then, when a Seattle Democrat kind of pushed back, Honeyford said this.
Poor more likely to commit crimes, and colored most likely to be poor. I didn't say anything else than that, and I believe that's an accepted fact. If you check any of your sociology books or anything else, you'll find that's an accepted fact in our society.
Colored most likely to be poor. Then he told a Yakima TV station that the term colored did not apply just to the Negro or the Hispanic. Later in the week, Honeyford, who's, did I mention he's 76 years old and white, he represents a majority Latino district, and he said the language he chose is not appropriate in 2015. It is a privilege to serve in the public arena, and I will continue to represent my entire community with diligence and increased sensitivity. What does he have to apologize for?
Quick shout out first to Ansel Hertz, the reporter at The Stranger who broke this story.
Way to go, Ansel.
Way to go, Ansel.
Well, I think it actually, you know, so his first reference was the more common usage today, people of color. And then it just got worse from there for him for some of the terms that he used.
Why is people of color so much better than colored people?
One is a more modern term and one is a sort of more old-fashioned and was used in a derogatory manner. That is a fact. And in this case, you know, here's a guy, he's from a majority-minority district, isn't that right?
Yes.
And they've had a ton of troubles over there in electing people from the Latino community to their various city councils and things like that. So he should have, could have, would have, I guess, is where I'm going here. Somebody needed to stop the way he kept referring to this. You know, he should have stopped himself, actually. Even his wife told him to stop what he was doing, and he didn't. So the apology was the only thing that was available. But, you know, in the whole scheme of things, it's more how the person votes, I would think, on some of these things. And I understand, you know, there is a voting rights bill in the legislature, and I understand his seatmate from the same place actually voted for that, was one of the Republicans that voted for that. And so maybe that's where the action should be, you know, is how he votes.
And I think the problem with the larger statement is that, you know, I think our consciousness is being raised, those of us who are not people of color, about the degree to which disparities are driven by the way the law is enforced and who's enforcing the law. We're looking at our police departments, and that Ferguson is a great example. Seattle is also an example. So I think that the sense that somebody in Republican leadership who should be sensitive to this apparently is kind of deaf to the idea that there may be reasons other than something inherent in being poor or being a person of color that is at play in why some of these numbers are so disproportional. He just seems clueless on that point.
Yeah, you're discussing that was the gist. That was the subject they were actually talking about. And that what got most of the attention, just pinging around the web, was lawmaker apologizes for saying colored people, when his setup to what set that off was saying people of color are more likely poor than not. Which I'm not sure, does that mean more likely poor than people not of color? Or did he mean that more than 50% of people of color live below the poverty line, which he should know isn't true? It's maybe 25%, but the heat went to the word colored.
I mean, he was trying to, like Knut said, explain away the disproportionate impact of law enforcement and incarceration and everything else by saying, well, you know, people in poverty are likelier to commit crimes, people of color are likely to be in poverty, therefore we don't really have a problem here, when actually all the studies, all the research, all the sociology shows we do have a problem here with disproportionate impacts and enforcement and selective enforcement and selective impacts. And it does have a racist racial component, and it's just true. You know, if you are a person of color in front of a jury, in front of a prosecutor, you're likelier to be punished, likelier to be imprisoned. Even if you're not mixed up in the criminal justice system, if you're a person of color, if you're a black kid, a black girl in a school, you're likely to be suspended or expelled for doing the exact same thing that a white kid in that exact same school did. There's all sorts of evidence that there is a systemic problem with racism and racial discrimination in our country.
And that was the more important bottom line than his 76-year-old guy's word choice.
Right. And so the whole thing blows up, and it's about word choice. But in a way, maybe it's shedding light on the underlying topic.
Yes. In a moment, we're going to talk about the thing you least want to compost that maybe could happen, depending on who you are. Just before that, very quickly, we've been telling you how easy it is to tell your government to release millions of its internal emails, but how hard it is for government to actually do that. This week, Hillary Clinton gave us the solution. You just use your personal email account for everything, and then you just release what you want to release when it's all done.
It was kind of not the right solution, because it sort of reaffirmed in some ways this Bill Hill, we're above all the rules, don't apply to us. That wasn't pretty.
And we found out by the end of the week that Jeb Bush's own staff had the exact same problem, that they were using a private server and private email addresses to conduct state business when he was governor of Florida.
Yeah, I think this is more standard practice, which is why there's sort of initial drooling that, oh, there's another Clinton scandal. And then kind of like a lot of Clinton scandals, it's like, well, it's not quite as scandalous maybe as it seemed.
It wasn't quite an email-stained blue dress.
Exactly. Okay, so you're saying some
white
things,
and gold all along.
You're saying some things are large, seem large, and then you dispose of them, they actually get boiled down to something much, much smaller?
But what sticks in the public imagination is, oh, Clinton's being weaselly and bending the rules to their own advantage. Yeah, Knut's right about that. That's going to stick.
You know where I'm going with this, Knut.
Everybody does it.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk.
I think you're talking about Grandma.
We're going to talk about Grandma in a moment on the Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. Knute Berger, Joni Balter, and Dan Savage. How are we doing, everybody?
I have to pee.
Well,
but I can hang on for 5 more minutes.
5 minutes is all I ask.
Did you see the size of the coffee he's drinking?
It is. Well, it's tea, actually. I'm not.
Or whatever.
Come to the Seattle coffee cult.
It's an aquarium, is what it is.
I thought since we were going to be talking about natural human processes here that I could throw okay. that out there, that my bladder is...
Yes,
exactly. Seattle, you need to know that.
We're easing you into this next topic because I may be about to gross you out, so take that into consideration. Picture a building in Seattle where you walk in, say goodbye to, not necessarily Granny, but your departed loved one, and you place your beloved's body into some wood chips and straw and let him rot. That is the goal of the Urban Death Project, which the Stranger profiled this week. We recycle everything in Seattle. It's your shell. Why can't you have yourself composted? Joni, who's disgusted by this idea?
Well, I tried reading all lines of the story.
Brendan Kiley.
I was like intrigued for a minute, and then I was grossed out, and then I was intrigued because, you know, there's a lot of us, and we are going to all kind of die and take up space and all of that. But in the end, I just thought composting all of us sort of happily together.
And not just composting.
And some of the neighbors come with you. It just...
Yeah. Yeah. What is your problem with that? Is it something you can't articulate?
It's probably in the can't articulate, but I just was hoping for a little bit more privacy in my final resting.
I was going to say, I couldn't stand like co-housing when I was alive, you know.
What I loved about the proposal was they want to build these basic human composting towers in neighborhoods, which will make apartments much less controversial. Apartments are going to seem awesome by comparison to the
and they
human
don't need parking
composting
spaces.
Bin.
Let's look on the bright side. They do not need parking spaces.
Yes. Well where you they have park you this is where you park. I mean, we should capture what this is like, right? Did I basically do it?
You
people on top.
You left an important part out. You lay people on top. It's like the old school hippie backyard composting bin where you put them in on top, put the waste in on top, and then out the bottom you get compost to spread in the garden. What you're supposed to do is return to this tower in 6 months or a year and collect compost that includes your loved one's remains and then spread them in your tomato patch back at the house.
Soylent Green. It's people.
It is people. Could this ever happen?
No.
Ever?
I don't think. Well,
why?
In a way, it's kind of a return to the graveyards of old, where people used to be buried for a couple of years in the churchyard, and then they would dig that grave up and put somebody new in it. It was basically a composting pile underground as people decomposed.
So what's the problem?
And churchyards were charnel houses. I don't know. It's just kind of icky.
Well, traditional cemeteries, a lot of people have a problem with them. They're often maintained with agrochemicals.
Maybe if the compost is fine enough, you can spread it all over Snoqualmie Pass and snowboard on it. If there's no snow.
I was just thinking, you know, if Richard Conlon were still on the city council, this would probably become mandatory, but you could put him in the
only with
in
goats,
the yard
though.
Waste
he
bin.
Would include the goats.
You could you could just put the dead in the yard waste bin, and then it could...
But it's Richard Conlon's political career that is in the compost bin right now, thank God.
We think this idea is going nowhere. I'm signing up. I'm just
really?
On the record. I have no problem with this. It's a shell, and bring it on.
I think it should be legal.
Okay.
I think it would be a good option.
Okay, we have just a moment left to say goodbye to the deceased. It's sort of we're propping up the PI Globe. This is, you know, the globe that sat on top of the PI building. I won't tell you what a PI is right now, but the globe.
Post Intelligencer, sir.
Yes, an old newspaper. It was a newspaper, and I don't have time to tell you what a newspaper was, but they're putting the globe. Finally, they decided to put it at Myrtle Edwards Park. Good idea?
I think it would be fine because it's sort of, if you think of the extension of it, there's the sculpture gardens there, and it would just be sort of a continuation of it.
But what will that mean to people? It's in the PI. What will anyone make of that?
Yeah, it's an art object now.
Politically incorrect?
It's like, what is the R on top of the old brewery mean? It's just an R.
It's in the public intoxication. It's in the...
All I hear right now is the word P.
My understanding is it's not going in Myrtle Edwards Park. It's going to be there. The rumor is it's going to be adjacent to it, but not on public property. So that suggests maybe on top of somebody else's roof.
We're not going to put it on top of the Calder.
To my children, that sculpture is about the irrational number pi. The globe is a sphere, and the area of its circle is is the pi r squared.
Wow, smart kids.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's all you need to know,
3.14 something, whatever it was.
Should we let Dan Savage go? I'm feeling sorry for him.
I'm going to go right here if we're not careful.
Okay, Dan Savage from The Stranger and Savage Love, Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail, Knute Berger, the Mossback from Crosscut.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you,
Bill.
Jason Pagano produces the show. We're at KUOW on Twitter, Facebook, Public Radio, and we'll be with you in a week. Yeah, week in review. Thanks.